Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and pleased to welcome back Bassam Shakashiri, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at the UW-Madison, a national proponent for science and education. And we're going to talk with him about a whole bunch of things, actually. The summer solstice, the importance of science communication. We can look at climate change, and we can talk about Independence Day as well with him. And I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts. How do we communicate science to the public? Are we doing a decent job? How could it be improved? What other science questions do you have? Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Bassam Shakashiri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. I'm always happy to be with you and our listening audience. It's such a wonderful time and a time for mutual benefit and interactions. I love hearing from our listeners.
Well, I tell you what, let's start with the summer solstice. And maybe just from a science standpoint, probably good to talk about what is the solstice.
Well, it's technically speaking, it's an astronomical occasion. It relates to the distance between the Earth and the Sun, and the position of the Earth. The word, as you mentioned already, you know, comes from Latin. It is the longest day of the calendar year, longest day in the sense of daylight. Yeah. The day is 24 hours and a few seconds every day. In the northern hemisphere, that is, it's the longest day. This is the summer solstice. In the southern hemisphere, excuse me, it's the winter, where it's the shortest daylight there.
Well, there's a lot culturally, there's a lot of significance to the solstice.
Yes. Going way back, you know, our ancestors worshipped the sun and followed, made all kinds of celestial observations and calculations related to the sun. By the way, Larry, before I continue, I really would like to ask the audience, if they are inclined to do so, to call in and tell us, maybe one or two people would call in and tell us why we have four seasons. This is all related to the equinox and to this summer and winter solstice and so on. So you and I have done this before, but our audience changes every year. So would someone please call and try to explain to all of us why we have four seasons? But back to the cultural, you know, pre-Christian traditions for the Greeks, some say that it marked the start of a new year. The Romans had their own ideas about this, the Chinese, the Mayans, many Native American tribes celebrated the longest day of the year with a sun dance, all kinds of cultural traditions that developed because of the of what is called the solstice, and all of this, you know, to me tells us that we make observations, we try to make sense out of these observations, we make celebrations based on what we experience. Sometimes we come up with the wrong explanation. Sometimes we come up with good explanations. It's a cultural thing. And so that's why I'm interested right now to see if anyone is going to call in and try to share if they know why we have four seasons.
And by the way, the number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. I was interested in some research on the connections between happiness and the amount of sunlight in the day. I found it interesting, and I think it sort of matches the way I feel about the amount of sunlight.
Well, our mood depends on daylight. Now, I don't know how valid are these scientific studies. I don't. I mean, you know, this is a psychological thing, but it's clear that our mood is affected by daylight, and that contributes to our feeling happy. Or feeling, you know, it's a cloudy, overcast day. All of these changes in our environment have an effect on us, and it's important to recognize that the amount of light that we receive from the sun, natural daylight, has a good effect on us. Yes, but I don't know. I can't cite any studies that confirm that.
There's some interesting attempts at it. Anyway, Steve in Chippewa Falls wants to comment on the four seasons. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning. I'm just guessing, but there's a longest day, and there's a shortest day, and there's a period where the you're going from the longest to the shortest, you know, I wonder if those periods where you're getting longer and you're getting shorter, that would be four, from longest to maybe I'm confused here, but I think that there's a period of time when you're getting shorter, and a period of time when you're getting longer, and But why? What is it? Maybe it's because of the. I guess my guess is unreasonable. What is the answer? If you would, or I'll wait for a better answer.
All right. No, I like the fact that you called. Thank you for doing that, and thank you for sharing your thinking, and we all work together to try to share what we're thinking about.
We've got another guy who's got a comment on that as well, Bassam.
Okay. All right.
Let's go to Mike in Racine. Mike.
Hi. Thanks. Yeah, your first caller, he came pretty close. We have four seasons because the Earth's position in terms of its direction of pointing relative to the sun always remains static. So that the North Pole is always pointed at the same place in the sky, and the South Pole is always pointed at the same place in the sky. So as we go around the sun, we can separate that circle into four quarters, and those four quarters are where the northern pole is closest to the sun and where the southern pole is closest to the sun, but where the both poles are equidistant from the sun on either side of that circle, sort of looking down on our rotational orbit. And those four quarters increase or decrease the amount of daylight that we have. So the amount of daylight that we have is increasing from the winter solstice to the summer solstice. And it's increasing faster and faster and faster as we approach the vernal equinox, and then slower and slower and slower as we approach the summer solstice. And our decreasing daylight is increasing from our summers are from our decreasing daylight, the amount of decrease is increasing from our summer solstice to our autumnal equinox, and then decreasing is slowing as we go from the autumnal equinox to the winter solstice.
This is a wonderful conversation. So, but can you also say more about what causes the season to happen? You're describing what happened. Is there some explanation that you might know of that is the cause of having four seasons? We could have one season, but we don't have one season.
Well, the amount of daylight that we receive, because it's increasing or decreasing over those periods of time, the period of time of daylight increases the amount of energy that falls on the landmass or on the water. And then because of that, that daylight is energetic and produces heat. And if you have a darker, colder time period, or a warmer, lighter time period, the what happens to the vegetation and what happens to us changes because we're constantly experiencing either less or more daylight and thus less or more heat. So our spring is our period of time from, you know, March 21st to June 21st. And that's the period of time when we're getting more and more and more daylight is approaching the time period where we're going to finally max out our daylight and thus our heat. And that helps all our plants grow. It helps us as we have later time periods. And then, of course, the summer is the time period from June 21st to September 21st. And that time period is the summer. And that's the warmest period of the time because we've got the most light and we hit the max light on June 21st or June 22nd.
This is all good, but there's something else that should be part of what we're talking about. It has to do with the tilt of the Earth. Mm-hmm. The Earth is tilted, and you know, another question is why is the Earth tilted? But so let me just say very quickly, a long time ago, the Harvard Astrophysics Laboratory conducted a study at the Harvard University graduation asking faculty and students why we have four seasons. And I will tell you, this is documented. It's in a program called Private Universe, which I will post on my website after we finish with this program. 21 out of 23 could not explain why we have four seasons. And it's a study that has to do with our conceptions, our misconceptions, how we try to explain natural phenomena, and so on. I've seen the conversations we've had so far, Larry, with our two guests have been fantastic. So please check my website, scifun.org, shortly after the program here, and I will put a link to this short video that tries to explain why we have four seasons. It has to do with the tilt of the Earth and the rotation of the planet.
Yeah. Mike, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call very much. But Sam Shakashiri, our guest today, taking a look at science. We started with the summer solstice, and we're getting into other topics as well as we move along. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking science with Bassam Shakashiri, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at UW-Madison. And we've been dealing a little bit with the solstice and still have a comment or two before we move on from that. Jody in Oconomowoc, what's on your mind?
Well, I think Dr. Bashari already explained it. Yeah, I was just going to say it's the tilt of the axis, 23.5 degrees, and the angle of that the sun reaches the surfaces, and that's why we have the imaginary lines of the equator and the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn. And I think he did a great job explaining it. So he already gave the answer.
Right. Well, Jody, you know, the process of conversing about the so-called answer is important. So what you say, thank you for what you're saying. Why is the Earth tilted? Do you know?
I'm not really 100% sure about that. I'm drawing a blank. But anyway, it's tilted, I think, because of the spin, but I'm not sure about that. And it's kind of like as it goes around the orbit of the sun, the 365 days, that angle stays consistent, but it sometimes is pointed towards the north or towards the North Pole, towards one direction, South Pole, obviously the other. But it's the tilt, I want to say, is, and you know, I really don't even know anymore.
Well, that's right. It's very good to say I don't know, because this is how we start thinking about what you know, how to go about it. So a meteor hit our planet and caused the tilt a long time ago. And that's why the rotation of the Earth is what it is, in addition to considering, you know, going around the sun and so on. So it's the change in the axis of the Earth, the tilt, and of course that is attributed to a meteor a very long time ago that hit the Earth and caused it to tilt. So anyway, please look at this program called Private Universe. I will post it within the hour after we get off the air here. It explains in some detail. It's a very short clip, but you'll find it interesting in terms of why people should be thinking about concepts and try to avoid misconceptions.
Judy, thank you so much. You know, this has been kind of fun because it goes along with what other things that we were planning to talk about. One, communicating science. Here we were talking among ourselves about it, and communicating science to the general public. It comes up often when you talk with us, and for good reason. It's really key to public buy-in, which also leads to maybe political commitment as well.
Yes, there are very significant aspects to the importance of communicating with each other about science and about natural phenomena and about the consequences of scientific advancements. By science, I also mean technology, scientific and technological advancement. I think the more conversations we have about this, the better we understand the beauty and complexity of the planet that we live on. And Larry, I would like to commend you for all the programs that relate to science that you have every week. Not only the weather guys that are coming on right after us, but you have science in so many aspects that relate to our daily lives. And, you know, consequences are economic, they're cultural, they're social. And scientists have a responsibility to share the discoveries in manners that are comprehensive, that can be comprehended by everyone. It's not that scientists know all the answers and they're keeping them to themselves. It's important to develop the skill of respectful communications about matters that relate to evolution, global warming, food safety, healthcare, all of these matters that are crucial to the well-being of everyone in society should be discussed openly. And this is why I commend you, Larry, for doing this in so many different ways every week. And I like the participation of the audience in these conversations. But I think that we should be aware that we, in conversing with each other, we should be respectful of each other as fellow human beings. I'm not saying we respect somebody's ideas or somebody's thinking about it, but we engage in respectful conversations, because if we don't have these conversations, then a lot of things that we can and should do something about will not be done. And that specifically, I'm referring now to matters that relate to helping mitigate global warming. There are natural causes to global warming. There's no doubt about that. But there is no doubt either that human activity since the Industrial Revolution has tremendously increased the amount of carbon dioxide gas, which is a greenhouse gas, being put into the atmosphere because we relies so heavily on fossil fuels as a source of energy. I would say, Larry, in the past 5 to 10 years, there has been more awareness of the importance of helping mitigate global warming before it gets to be too late. The planet is warming. There's no question about that. The real question is, what do we individually and collectively do? There have been many governmental policies put in place. They're not all being implemented. This is a planet situation. It's not peculiar to geographic location. Although in the industrialized world, we put more carbon dioxide into the air than the rest of the world because we, again, rely heavily on the use of fossil fuels. And there are transitions that are being suggested and should be followed so that we consider alternative green ways to meet our energy needs. There's no question about this.
We have other callers online with comments. Let's go to Jim in Cedarburg. Jim, thank you for calling.
Thanks, Larry. My question is there a mathematical formula to determine the strength of the sun that we get on June 21st versus what they're receiving on the tropics, Tropic of Capricorn? Is there a straightforward mathematical equation?
That's a good question. Yes, there are such. I don't know what they are, but I will look them up and post them on my website for you. And this is a very good question. It has to do with the amount of sunlight and how it reaches different parts of the world. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And you'll post that on scifund.org.
Yes.
All right, Jim, it'll be there, I promise you. Thank you for calling. Chris in Black Creek, hi.
Hey, guys, great day, great show as always. Yes, your caller, a couple of callers just hit it right the nail on the head. And I just wanted to add in a little something about the caller that mentioned the North and South Poles, or callers, that most people don't realize that those two poles actually wobble in an elliptical fashion. And so the same with the elliptical movement of the sun, we get closer and further away. It's an elliptical movement. And so the North and South Pole actually make an elliptical wobble in the shape of an egg. So that could contribute to the four seasons. And as the one caller mentioned with seeds, yes, if we didn't have winter, for example, the seeds wouldn't be able to winterize so that you could plant them in the spring.
Bassam, comment?
Yes. This is just great. There should be a good understanding of why we have the four seasons and the consequences of having the four seasons, both in the Northern Hemisphere and in the Southern Hemisphere, as well as the effect of human activity, not on the seasons, but on the temperature of the planet. And the planet temperature has been rising because of the trapping of the heat by the greenhouse gases, specifically carbon dioxide. But you know, the biggest greenhouse gas is water vapor. And we can't do anything about that. That's because of the water cycle. But as the planet warms up, and it's happening, then more water vapor gets into the atmosphere. And there are other consequences that affect the acidification of the oceans and all kinds of other things that are really related to our understanding of the beautiful, complex world that we live in. And all of these questions and all of these ideas and all of these answers should be part of a continuing conversation we have with our families, with our friends, with our neighbors, depending on what people are interested in. Yeah. So thank you for pointing out what you did.
Yeah, a listener called, couldn't stay with us, but just wanted to clarify that it's not the rotation of the Earth, but the revolution of it around the sun that creates the season. The very important words, but to keep that in mind, it's the rotation of the Earth. It's not the rotation of the Earth, but the revolution of it around the sun that creates the seasons.
Yes, and the tilt of the axis. Watch this short clip. It's just wonderful. It's many, many years old, but it is really a good telltale of how we develop an understanding of the complexity and the simplicity of natural phenomena.
Ross in Middleton emailed us wondering if the science curriculum in high schools, public versus private, are the same, the curriculum, are the outcomes measured, and are they similar?
That's a very good question. It's a great concern to me and to many others in our society about the quality of education in our schools, whether they're public or private. I think it's important to have in the curriculum the most recent and best understanding of science, and other aspects of human endeavors, not just science, and our culture, our social interactions with each other, all of these should be included, and members of the school board should insist on having this be in the curriculum, and the teachers should be prepared, and many of them are. To discuss accurately and with validity such questions. Now, as far as the differences as measured between private and public school, there are studies about that, but I just call attention to the most recent study that I have learned about, and it shows that a decrease in reading skills across all schools, and that's of concern. Reading is an important skill. I'll put a link to that study also on my website. Reading, mathematics, comparing school children by grade are all done by a national federal group, and I'll put a link to that. This is of great concern.
Thanks very much for that comment. Someone else is wondering about what are the obstacles of scientists getting their messages out?
Well, it takes a will on the part of scientists to share concepts in science with others. And the researchers are sharply focused on the work that they are doing, and they should be. But researchers and all scientists, technologists, have a responsibility to share their findings in understandable ways with others who are not as technically skilled. So scientists know how to communicate with each other very, very well through the scientific literature, through scientific conferences, and so on. But scientists are beginning to learn how to communicate with people who are not scientists and do it, as I said already, in respectful ways, so that there'll be conversations and willingness to listen to the non-science people who are wanting to express themselves, ask questions, engage in, as I keep saying, respectful conversations, respectful of each other as fellow human beings. So scientists and especially, you know, in graduate schools, students and postdoctoral fellows and their mentors have become more aware of the importance of this. I can't help but mention one specific program that we have at University of Wisconsin-Madison. We encourage all PhD graduate students to include a chapter in their PhD thesis describing their scholarly work to a non-science audience, explaining the scholarly work in this chapter to family members, to friends, to others in the community, to elected officials, to newspaper reporters. And this has been going on for over a decade, Larry. And all of these chapters are developed by the graduate students themselves, the PhD candidates, and with the help of an editor that we have. And they are then posted on the Sciences Fund website, and sometimes they're sent to other people who are interested in them. So I call attention to that. It's on the website as well, scifun.org, scifun.org. Science communication is crucial, and the communicators of science must be scientists themselves, as well as others who know about the techniques and skills of effective communication, which includes a very important dimension, the dimension of being willing and able to listen to others in a conversation.
Yeah. I was thinking back some years back, probably prior to the time you were talking about, one of my favorite questions in an oral defense of a PhD student was to ask that question. If it wasn't.
Yes. If, yes.
And yes. Sometimes the results were pretty good, and sometimes they weren't so good. So it's
You're right. Sometimes they're pretty good. Sometimes they're not as good. But they should all be good. And everyone should, who engages in scientific and technological research, should develop the skill of sharing their scholarly work with others outside the discipline of science, outside the discipline of technology, because all of these scientific advances and technological advances that we do when we do research have an effect on everyone. And so, you know, the way I phrase it sometimes is, why rob the joy of learning from others? Let others be part of this conversation.
Richard in Livingston, New Jersey, we go to you. Thanks for calling, Richard.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I'm just wondering what trends give Shaka Sherry hope that we can solve the climate crisis.
Yeah.
I'm an optimist. I'm a realist also. I think addressing the climate situation is something we should be doing all together collectively around the world, individually in our local community, but also on a state level and also nationally and worldwide. And it does mean that we have to develop the will to do it. And we have to realize that it's economically beneficial to us to do it. How optimistic am I about it? As I said, I'm a realist. I see some telltales of progress, but we're not doing enough. Richard, all of us, everywhere, in New Jersey, in Wisconsin, around the world, we should do more to really protect our planet and its inhabitants. And it is because of what human activity has greatly contributed to global warming. We can control that. And it takes the will to do it. It takes determination to do it. And it takes an adjustment on our part to do it. But it is all for the benefit of Earth and its people.
Thank you, Richard, for calling. But Sam, we've Independence Day is coming up pretty quick here, July 4th, and I know you like to talk about its meaning. Yes. and citizenship too.
Yes, Independence Day, 4th of July, fireworks, barbecues, all of that is what we enjoy. But the meaning of Independence Day, of the 4th of July, you know, Larry, there's a 4th of July in every country. But Independence Day in America is a celebration of the way of life that we have in America. It is, and here's what I do. Between the month of May and Independence Day, I read a document called American Trilogy. It has in it three components. One is the Declaration of Independence. I urge everyone to have a look at the Declaration of Independence. And then I look also, I read the second document is the Constitution, the United States Constitution. And the third document is the Bill of Rights. I know the Bill of Rights is part of the Constitution, but it came later. I think it's crucial for us as responsible citizens who enjoy the fullness of life in the United States to really understand what Independence Day means and what it boasts for us collectively, now, in the immediate future, and the long-term future. Yes, it is about barbecues and fireworks, but it's much more meaningful than that to me and to many other Americans. And I hope we renew our commitment to the American ideal and to the principles of democracy and to the republic that we all belong to. This is very crucial to me, and this is what I wanted to say. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to say it, and happy Independence Day, everyone.
But Sam, thank you very much for calling. By the way, there I wanted to mention there's a symposium honoring Bassam at the American Chemical Society Fall National Meeting in August. I took a look at the schedule. It's a wonderful honor for you, I'm sure, Bassam, and it's certainly well deserved. Thank you so much for your work and for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry, so much. I'm deeply honored, and I'm also embarrassed by all the nice things you say about me. So thank you, Larry. Thank you.
Bassam Shakashiri, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at the UW-Madison. A number of times during the show, he mentioned that he would be posting things on his website. And again, I will remind you that his website is scifun.org, scifun.org. Take a look, and I'm sure he's going to have those things posted soon. And already there's quite a bit of information on the website that science experiments, all kinds of things that you're going to find on his website, scifun.org. Well, the weather guys, I'm looking through a glass now into another studio, and I see them patiently waiting to come on in. John Martin, Steve Ackerman, coming up next. And one of the things we'll talk about is wildfires and weather. Can wildfires cause weather? Well, they'll answer that and a whole lot more. Next, I'm Larry Mueller.